Let's go, Lo-Fi Poli-Sci Podcast, coming at you. Michael Pickering here with our good friend Gregory Day, a writer, director, bookseller, and the voice behind Hitsville AD, a fanatical sect of the god of subculture and fervent ramblings of all breed of cinematic pleasures. How are you doing today, my friend Gregory Day?
Man, I'm doing great. How are you?
Doing well, doing well. Can't wait to talk about this one today. What kind of top 10 list you got for us? Go ahead and tell the listeners about it.
Hell yeah, man. I'm going to be talking about a list of top 10 gangster flicks, getting down and dirty into those films about family and loyalty in organized crime. So little disclaimer, we're not going to be getting into kind of the offshoots of the gangster film. We're really talking about movies that deal with organized crime, family, loyalty. And so we're going to kind of keep it narrow, but in true fashion, we're going to do international picks and American flicks, but we're going to do a little different this time. We're going to start with the international ones, and then the second half of the list, we're going to break it down into just the American ones, since it's such a prolific genre for us here in the States. But just to get something out of the way, we're not going to talk about The Godfather, and we're not going to talk about Goodfellas. And those are masterpieces, undoubtedly. I think no one can argue with that. But I wanted to be able to move those movies to the side and allow us to talk about some other gangster films that are just as good or important to the genre. So don't expect to hear us talk much about those films today.
All right. Sounds good. And yeah, you kind of addressed a question I was having, you know, while I was reviewing the list and everything like that. I was thinking, I would like you to dive into it a little bit more for listeners here, because the word gangster, like with a hard ER versus gangsta, is like what it's thought about today. This word has definitely evolved over time. And I think the list that we're about to go over kind of shows that. But specifically, you started talking about like family and organized crime. You want to go a little bit more into what you mean by gangster and how it relates to that and how it portrays this list?
Yeah. So this list is going to be really focused on organized crime in a fashion where it deals with families and loyalty and honor and these sort of these systems. And so we're not going to be talking about film like heist films or other crime thrillers. They may have, you know, criminal elements to them, or people who are professional criminals, whether that be hitmen or, you know, bootleggers, or, I mean, there's some of that stuff in here, but like, this is very specific to how these, the gangster film in relation to almost hierarchical scenarios, loyalty, family, and the trappings of those things and how they play into, you know, leading people into these kinds of lives.
All right, good. Sounds good. And I'm going to ask you a little bit more later after the list about, you know, where like some of those exact things you were talking about too, because like I said, the word gangster these days, it can mean a lot of things. And
Oh yeah.
So we're going to talk about that and how gangster films have evolved over time, but let's go ahead and jump into this. Go ahead and lead us off with your number 10, buddy.
Yeah. Number 10, we're going to start in India with a massively epic film called The Gangs of Wasseypur. This is a 5-hour saga.
Really?
Oh, yes. It's three generations of organized crime family feud in India. It's based on a true story of these warring crime families. But this starts in like the days of, you know, riding a horse to rob a train with the British, rob the British on their trains, up to now where there's like escalation to AK-47 violence. And it's the tales of this inherited cycle of violence as the generations continue to take up the mantle of this fight between these warring families. But at the heart of it, it's about this character. There's the Khan family and the Singh family, but at the heart of it, there's this sort of Michael Corleone character, which is the smart son who is not involved in the organized crime, and he's the one who proves to be the most cunning and takes over his family and pushes them forward and kind of, you know, revolutionizes his family to be the winning family. This is a really great film. It's very modern. It's not like the Bollywood tradition. It's part of this new wave of modern Hindi cinema, which is more gritty, more realistic, more action oriented. It doesn't have the song and dance kind of mold of Bollywood. It doesn't have the flashy production of the Bollywood films. And this one, it was released in two parts, which is why it's so long. But I think at least here in the States, the way I saw it, it was released on Netflix as a serialized version. So you could watch it like a television show where it was broken into like eight parts or something like that. But yeah, this is a great part. This is like a great example of like what modern gangster cinema looks like.
I love this, and it came out in 2012, and I like the idea you said you can watch it on Netflix like broken up into serialized, because I think, and this would lead me to a question, I think U.S. audiences, a five-hour flick is just out of the question. There's no way you're gonna watch a five-hour flick. No one does. Mm-hmm. But like breaking it up into chunks, I think you're like targeting your audience as well. But is this an uncommon release for such a long film in India to come out, or has it happened more common?
Do you mean with the five-hour runtime?
Yeah.
That's tough because I think Indian audiences are used to long films. 5 hours might be pushing it, but there are some other really long Indian films. But traditionally, Indian films are long. The audiences love the long movies. They love all of the different kinds of variety it allows for them to experience in a movie setting. The communal viewing of long movies is really great for them. I mean, it's great for everyone, but like that's really part of their culture, is going to the movie and see a huge movie with their family and their friends and participate in the movie. So this is definitely not uncommon. I don't know if a 5 hour movie is very common, but yeah, their movies are typically long.
And I love that. And for 5 hours, and you talking about the film covers three generations. And so I haven't seen this film, but the trailer, well, I'll talk about more in a second, but the idea of three generations of a criminal crime family feud going back to pre-independence, you know, pre-1949, all the way to today when the film was released in 2012, that is pretty epic of a saga to take a journey on with different people like that over time. And so the music, I thought, was phenomenal. And you know, they had some action in the trailers, and then there were, I don't know if these were just like all of the best quotes of the movies, but they had some awesome quotes in this trailer. Like one of them, how do you pronounce the name of the place again, please?
The way I say it is Waspur. I'm not sure if that's accurate.
Okay, Waspur. Well, I'll just use that one then.
Yes.
But one of the a criminal is talking to a police officer, and he's all up in his face, and he's like, "And Waspur, even a pigeon flies with only one wing because it needs the other wing to cover its ass." And it's like, whoa, like there's a whole lot of symbolism to that, especially when you're telling it to a police officer.
Yes.
But I think it's interesting because that when we think of crime families and generations, the amount of power that these criminal organizations had is immense. And they would talk to police officers like that. So I was just like, wow, I bet this movie's crazy. All right, my friend, what do you have for number nine for us?
Yeah, number nine, we're going to Hong Kong for a stone cold classic of the new wave movement of the 80s. This is A Better Tomorrow from 1986. This is the movie that put John Woo and Chow Yun-fat on the map, started their road to international fame. It's the story of two men who are in the money laundering game, and they're part of their own triad sort of organization, to where they get screwed over by their boss. And they have to rely on the loyalty between these two guys. They're not blood brothers, but they are pretty much all they have. But in the film, Fat's partner, his younger brother, is a police officer, which complicates things even further in the loyalty dynamic in the family. Whereas there's this character who has to weigh his brother, the loyalty of his younger brother, who's a police officer, and the loyalty of his lifelong friend, his partner in crime. And so again, things get very complicated. But what this film is really known for is, of course, started the heroic bloodshed movement of the 80s, which is these hyper-violent Hong Kong films, most of them made by John Woo. So The Killer, Hard Boiled, all that stuff. But it starts to dig into the difference between Western capitalism and how it's growing in Hong Kong, and then the old ways of loyalty in Chinese society, and how these two things don't really mix well, and it adds for some pretty destructive outcomes for these characters. So this is if you want to get into Hong Kong films of the 80s, this is a great starting point because it's got all the action, it's got all the symbolism of the times, and it's just a great flick all around.
I had not seen this one, but I'd noticed Chow Yun-fat was in it, and then I saw John Woo was the director, and I saw a couple other actors that I had seen before in other films, and I liked the tone of this trailer and it conveying of the message with the idea of the printing the money. And so you could see like, well, okay, so obviously they're in counterfeiting, but then one scene like really got, actually a couple of scenes where Chow Yun-fat is lighting a cigarette with $100 bill.
Yes.
And so a couple of things here. First is that we know it's probably fake because they're printing money. Mm-hmm. So it's like, oh, not a big deal. But at the same time, like, would it necessarily be obscene to think that someone in organized crime, just to show like status, would light a cigarette with a real $100 bill? Probably so, just because they think they could do it, you know, just because they don't care about money. They take what they want.
Yeah.
And then in another scene with him, he's literally smoking a cigarette with an unlit match in his mouth. And it's like, wow, you're just really tempting fate here, aren't you, buddy? So it was interesting to me. And I don't think I'd seen Chow Yun-fat so young in any other film that I'd seen before. So it was kind of interesting to see him as a young. And like you said, it was his upstart of his real acting career. So this one looked really interesting. It did.
Yeah. I would say it's like kind of the film that started like the two gun blasting kind of thing you get out of John Woo, the slow motion shooting that comes, you know, from this film all the way through Hard Target or Face Off in America, or even in his Mission Impossible film. But also it does redefine like what it means to be super cool in cinema. You have the trench coats, the sunglasses and all that stuff, you know, kind of creating that mythology for the Hong Kong gangster film. But yeah, I think there's another thing to say about burning that dollar. Is it says American dollar, it's not a Chinese dollar. And so there is sort of this this quality of nihilism to this, you know, and also like, is money real and all these, it doesn't really get that deep into things, but it does have these sort of symbols in the film where it is talking about the clashing between the American dollar coming in and how that doesn't quite mix well with the loyalty and the old ways of Chinese culture, since Hong Kong is so different from the rest of China.
I like it. I like the duality of the symbolism there for sure. All right, what you got for number eight for us?
Yeah, number eight is a harsh flick out of England from 1980 called The Long Good Friday. It stars Bob Hoskins from Roger Rabbit fame as this. Just
that's what he was in. I couldn't place it. Yes.
Yeah. He is. Mean motherfucker in this movie. He plays this gangster who is on the cusp of stepping out of his role in the underworld and launching himself into being a legitimate businessman by trying to broker this deal between all these corporate heads, the American mafia, all these European interests, and he really wants to make London the capital of Europe. And I don't think he's going to change his ways really, but he's taking that leap into corporate crime, basically. And it happens on Good Friday. And just as he's doing this, people start getting murdered around him. They're getting blown up, they're getting stabbed. All the people closest to him in his organization, people that go back to his childhood with him. And he spends the film trying to figure out who is after him. And it's this descent into the underworld that starts to reveal him, because we meet him on the yacht brokering this deal where he seems like this sort of businessman, but then as the film goes on, he's getting lower and lower in the underworld, trying to figure out who the hell's taking a shot at him, and he gets more and more savage in his violence and his demeanor. This is a really brutal film that shows the really dark underworld of London. It's got a lot of like Cockney accents and just really you know, low rent bars, and it's like a lot of hard faces in the film as well from the actors. And it's really interesting to see a film talk about London being the capital of Europe, whereas we have such a different worldview now. But yeah, it's really cool because you see a lot of these younger guys in this film show up later in Guy Ritchie movies as the older characters like Bricktop, And then the gangster in Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels is in the major gangster in that film is younger in this film too. So this is like a pinnacle of British gangster films.
Yeah, for sure. And I'm going to, you took the words out of my mouth referencing some of those things right there, because I'm not really familiar with a lot of UK gangster cinema. And although I kind of felt like I had heard this story before, and it really also made me think, you know, the Tom Hardy movie Legend, where he plays the twin gangsters.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it kind of made me think of that. And then it also made me think of Lock, Stock, Two Smoking Barrels or like Snatch. But like, that's the real extent of my knowledge or viewing of UK gangster films. So like to know that so much of that comes from this movie, it's interesting to me. And like you said, like 42 years now, right? So it came out in 1980.
Yeah.
That it all started here with this one. And like I said, I find it interesting because I feel like whenever we think about organized crime, and especially like familial ties, and we talk about the mafia, for instance, and some other ones that we're going to talk about here in a little bit, but we don't tend to necessarily think, at least not as an American, to think about the UK and organized crime and how that works with the familial ties and everything. So I find this one interesting for sure. All right, where are we going with number seven?
Yeah, at number seven, we're going to Japan. This is probably one of my favorite gangster films ever made. It's called Street Mobster from 1972. It's one of the most nihilistic views of organized crime I think I've ever seen. It's about this man named Okita who gets out of prison.
Real quick. So like, I'm familiar with the term nihilist, but I'm mm-hmm. probably betting most listeners aren't. So let's go into what that really means first and how we're using it.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think this is just, it's kind of, this film is going to get to the heart of how a lot of things are theater in the life of organized crime, as all many films I think on this list we're going to start getting into. Family, loyalty, and all these things don't mean shit when it comes down to the bottom line, and they don't really believe in all these things. And that's what I'm getting at when I say nihilism, is that the gangsters don't really believe in these things because it's survival and taking care of yourself are the number, like the top things, top priorities of a gangster. And so
right, exactly. Nihilism, like they believe in nothing, even though the code is supposed to be family. A nihilist really doesn't believe in anything.
Correct. Just, yes.
And that's what it is. Like, family is nothing but theater. Money is the only thing that matters.
Absolutely. Yes.
All right. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Yeah. So, you know, and if you're not familiar, Yakuza is the families similar to the mafia, which have their own codes and history and loyalty embedded into them in Japan. And so Okita gets out of prison and he realizes that his hometown has been taken over by two really large groups. And so he gets his crew back together and he's going to take them on. But he soon finds out that these families are more corporatized than his old crew is. He's nothing but a street gangster at this point. And he's aiming to take on these two really embedded families that have their tentacles in all sorts of businesses and corporations and the police and all this stuff. And it really starts to get down to where all the things that he believed that the Yakuza should be, you know, they don't really stand up. It's all about the greed and the money at the end of the day and the self-preservation. But what I really like about this film is that Okita is a really awful character, and it explores him three-dimensionally. So he is this really terrible guy who has murdered people, and he, before going away to prison, he would kidnap women and force them into sex trafficking. And by the end of the picture, you really get a great portrait of a life of regret, and it packs a real big emotional punch in the end when Okita is faced with kind of reflecting on his life and the choices he's made, and that he really understands that there's no way or no place for him to go other than, you know, towards death, and that this kind of lifestyle is only going to end in violence. So it's a really flashy film. It's got a lot of great handheld camera work, and it's got a frenetic energy. The director, Kenji Fukasaku, is one of the most famous gangster directors from Japan. He did this really famous series called The Battles Without Honor and Humanity, which is like a 5-movie epic about post-war Japan and the Yakuza. But for me, this is the one where to start, where his style truly takes off. And it's just one of the best gangster pictures I can ever imagine.
So this one I hadn't seen before, but the trailer, I think the trailer and your description of it really kind of work hand in hand and to paint the picture of a film that even though it may be about the Yakuza, it really is just about chaos of a particular lifestyle. Oh, yeah. Totally. And like the brutality of the film as portrayed by the trailer, and you know, this just drinking, murder, sex trafficking, like all the horrible things that go into basically organized crime life. And so I want to ask you to clarify, because we may use these terms later. So, okay, whenever we talk about in a film, there's a protagonist and an antagonist. How would you define each of those terms?
So I would define those as your protagonist being the person that your movie is being told through, whether they are, no matter what their qualities are. So it's the person, the main character of the film that the person whose perspective the film is told through. The antagonist would be whatever that, you know, whoever the character is that's standing in their way or opposes them. So whether you're a gangster and the antagonist could be a police officer, or, you know, if we're talking about a superhero film, the superhero is the protagonist, and we have this, you know, the bad guy, the villain, like a Loki or whatever from the Joker is the antagonist in that scenario. But to me, without saying good or bad, antagonist and protagonist kind of allows you to have a character that maybe you don't necessarily agree with or wouldn't side with, but you're seeing the world through their eyes.
Okay, gotcha. And I wanted to do that because I am going to start using that in a little bit, but I just wanted to be clear for everyone. So whenever we say like the protagonist of a film, like you said, it's the person who leads the film. It doesn't mean that they're a good person.
No, not at all.
So like in this case, the protagonist you were just talking about is a horrible human being.
Absolutely.
Yeah, right. But thank you for that. But let's go ahead and kick it to your number six now.
Yeah, number six, we're going to Italy. A little taste of the exploitation genre called Polizio Tesci. And I'm going to get into what that means in a second. But this is a film from 1972 called Milano Caliber 9. This is a gangster film of the grittiest and most nihilistic order you can imagine. It's a different depiction of Italian crime than I think we have in America with the Italian-American experience and organized crime and the mafia. This is utterly savage, totally brutal, and completely nihilistic again. This is the tale of a guy named Ugo who gets out of prison and immediately is hunted down by his old family, who believes that he ripped them off of a good sum of money before he got arrested. And so there's this belief that he's squirreled some money away and they're looking for him, and that maybe he got himself arrested to prevent the repercussions of his actions. So there's this guy named Rocco who's after him, who is one of the most vicious gangsters ever portrayed in cinema. And this cat and mouse game of Rocco hunting him down and being there almost 24 hours a day, like busting through his front door or like watching him on the street or tailing him, trying to just hustle this guy. But it's a little ambiguity. Maybe Ugo did actually do this, and maybe he is more cunning than he lets on. So this is a film that just reveals some really nasty things about Italian society in the 70s with the bombings and just innocent people being killed without remorse. And there's that sort of code given to us in mafia depictions that does not exist here. So anyone and everyone is up for grabs here. Anyone can get hurt. Anyone can be killed. And to kind of explain what the Polizio Tesci genre is, it was a short-lived action crime genre in the 70s in Italy. They churned them out just like any other exploitation genre in Italy of this time, like horror films and so forth. But this one specifically was kind of a ripoff of the film, or not this movie, but this whole genre is a sort of a ripoff of The French Connection, the Gene Hackman film from the early 70s, where it was a lot of like fast-paced car chases and complex characters and really gritty modern characters, you know, kind of doing away with the way the 60s and 60s cinema. And so, yeah, this is one of the best examples of the Polizio Tesci genre, and its filmmaker Fernando De Leo is like a John Woo or a Kinji Fukasaka, who is just synonymous with this kinds of films from his own country, where he just depicted gangsters with both thrilling and sobering experiences.
Yeah, I like this one, and this one, once again, I have to say it so many times whenever I do list with you, it's one I haven't seen. You know, but looking at the trailer, like you got the impression that it was all about the hunt for that $300,000. And, you know, who is this person really? Like, did he take the money? Did he not take the money? And what is he willing to do afterwards. You know, I thought it was pretty cool to think about Italian crime isn't all about the mafia. And even the mafia isn't all about the mafia in many ways. Like, and I think showing that in a country that is stereotyped for the mafia, that's just one dynamic of criminal activity, really. But I will say one thing that really took me from this trailer, or that I took from this trailer at the very end, they start doing cut shots of different like switcheroos, like leaving a package in public and someone else picking it up and things like that. And I was like, and you know, you see that in other flicks, but you're like, you know, that used to take place, right? Like criminals used to do that kind of stuff, but there's no way they could still do it, right? Like, no way. There's way too much surveillance going on right now.
Yeah.
Like,
no, not in the surveillance. Yeah.
And organized crime used to exist, and as portrayed in this film and a lot of the other ones, in the public. Like, these families, be it Yakuza or Mafia or Triads, they existed in the public domain of life. But just as surveillance cameras came, it seems like a lot of them have disappeared. But truly, they couldn't have all disappeared. But that's something we'll talk about later. But that whole switcheroo thing just made me think about it for sure.
Yeah, and one more point about this film, I think I forgot to make earlier, was kind of getting back to family and loyalty thing. There is this earned loyalty by the end of the movie between Rocco and Ugo about the fact that they're both in this life, and that there's a shared respect, even though these two guys would kill each other in a heartbeat. It kind of does get around in a weird way, having said all that, that there is this respect and loyalty earned by the end of the film.
Save your life, though.
No, it's such a weird juxtaposition because of the lifestyle they lead, but there is this strange respect that is presented in the film by the end.
Yeah, I think, like you said, though, how much of that is really just theatrics, or at least in their own minds, or in the mind of a sociopath, perhaps, which I don't want to talk about that word too much, because in a few films, that word's going to come up a lot. All right, what do we have for your number five, your top five list?
All right, so the next five are going to be, we're shifting gears into the American cinema. And the first one I want to talk about is The King of New York from 1990. This is, I would say, a fairly famous movie, but not as famous as a lot of other gangster films. It's the story of Frank White, who's played by Christopher Walken, who gets out of prison and he returns to New York. He kind of gets a view of what's going on in the city, the drug epidemics, and the gentrification going on. And he decides he is going to wipe out all of his competition across the city to save the city. He doesn't want to be the king of New York, but he, in a way, he will have to be in order to save it. And so this is him using his crew to wipe out the mafia, the triads, and ultimately the police, because the police are one of the gangs that kind of stands in his way of reaching his goal. And so in this film, he's a man who gets out, who has a lot of political pull, and he has a lot of hatred for him in the mafia, because he has an all black gang. And this is, you know, in one way, kind of talking about the end of some traditions in New York and the uprising of other traditions in New York, both culturally and racially. The one thing that fascinated me the most was the depiction of the police in this movie, because they are like the wildest gang in the city of New York, and they are just as brutal and just as vicious as any other gang in the streets. And it's that clash between the gangsters and the police that just proves that they're just two different gangs. There's no real law and order to this world of cops and robbers. It's got a great performance by Christopher Walken in the lead, but the truly shining performance of the film comes from Lawrence Fishburne, who is his right-hand man in his gang. And he's sort of the guy who's been kept the gang going while Frank was in prison. And there's this brotherly love between the two of them that really shines throughout the picture, even though they're two radically different individuals and from two different generations and probably from two parts of the city. They just make a great pairing. And Lawrence Fishburne is just stellar in the movie. And it's directed by Abel Ferrara, who was once a sleazy New York exploitation filmmaker, but he perfectly captures this world of the impending corporate takeover of organized crime and the city. And if you think about this movie, came out in 1990. By the end of the decade, we have the Giuliani takeover, the cleaning up of New York. And it was a little ahead of its time, but I think it really hit the nail on the head when talking about the eradication of organized crime in the city and the corporate takeover of it.
It truly, truly. I mean, that's a huge conversation in and of itself. But I have seen this film. It's been a long time. But whenever I saw young Christopher Walken's, young Lawrence Fishburne, young Wesley Snipes, mm-hmm. I was like, I knew exactly what this film was. And I remember it being a really, really good film that kind of just turns our traditional view of like what New York organized crime is, like Godfather, Goodfellas, Donnie Brasco, Gotti, things like that. And just is like, nope, this is something different. And I think you're right. It is ahead of its time. And it's really starting to get to the meat and potatoes of organized crime in New York was changing. And in the days, the old days of just, well, like we previously talked about, being so public about everything, and what John Gotti tried to do, but ultimately was the very end of, was that era of in-your-face gangster. And I think this film was really good and kind of shows that, like, it's all craziness. And like you said, you know, the police, and I think this film portrays it really well, the police sometimes are just as much gangsters as the gangsters themselves, without a doubt. We've seen quite enough real-life movies or movies that are based on historical fact or documentaries that show the strong links between strong organized crime families with police and the court systems and politicians and things like that. So I thought this one was a really good pick for all the reasons that you said.
Yeah.
All right, so now on to another one that I haven't seen, but... That sociopath, where it's going to come up in this one. Take us to your number four.
Yeah, number four is my oddball choice here, but it is a film that I really, really dig. It's called Mikey and Nikki from 1976, and it's not really focused. It doesn't really focus on the act of committing crimes in a organized way, but more of the consequences of that life. And so it's about these two guys, Mikey and Nikki, who are just bound together from childhood in their lives, the neighborhoods they're from, and they both are aging gangsters, or probably middle-aged gangsters. Mikey is this wild man who has a hit on him, and he can only rely on his best friend Nikki to help him try to get out of town. And so the movie takes place in one night as they trek across Philadelphia, and they have these long conversations about their childhoods and where they're going and what they're going to do, and like, you know, why Mikey is in trouble. But it's got this ambiguity to it, whether Nikki is setting him up to be killed eventually for whatever Mikey has done. And so, yeah, this is a film that's really about that family and loyalty thing. And one of these guys is completely out of control and turns on his friend and then wants his friend back. And then, you know, how do you deal with someone like that in your life, even though you've, you know, growing up with them, and now you're about as deep into something as you could possibly be, you know, in this life of organized crime. There's no real going back once you're in this. And the pressure's coming from that organization to punish those who step out of line, who break those codes. And the stresses it puts on both these guys, because one guy's running scared and the other guy's trying to corral the whole situation. So it's got two fantastic performances by John Cassavetes and Peter Falk, who are just some of the greatest American actors ever, especially during this time. And it's got a weird choice for a director, Elaine May, who is a really famous comedian. She was with Mike Nichols and when she was younger, and she did some other comedy films of the 70s, but her talents really lie in directing these actors and the pushing this naturalistic dialogue. And this is just a fantastic example of that gritty 70s filmmaking.
But I when this trailer started off, it was so intense. It seemed really more like a thriller, suspense, horror film, like how it was drawing you in, and the music was so tense. And then like one of them, Mikey or Nikki, whichever one it was, but just was going nuts, like was just a loose cannon sociopath all over the place, like always obsessing about someone's going to kill me tonight. Or like, and you could tell from the trailer that this was shot over one night and that this individual really thought it wasn't going to make it to the end of the night. And really, like, it got me to thinking that that's a great thing to portray on film about organized crime films or the people who are involved in them. Because these individuals are almost entirely sociopaths. Like, they're murderers, they're thieves, they're villains, and they likely deal with the kind of stress of someone's trying to kill me all the time. And that's, I'm going to make up a word, psychopathism, and it just drives them to do even more outlandish and crazy things.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that it was really cool to like zoom in to, like you said, the repercussions of a lifestyle rather than the lifestyle itself, and to really get a feel for these characters. And I didn't pick it up from the trailer, but I like the fact that there's the intrigue that is one character trying to actually set up his best friend to get him killed by the end of the movie. Like, is it just a ruse the whole thing? Mm-hmm. That's interesting. I dig it, man. I dig it. All right, now to number three.
Yeah, number three is one of the most important gangster films ever made. It's The Public Enemy from 1931. I had to include one of the OG films here because the American gangster movie really started in the 1930s. There are some silent gangster films, but it really took off pre-code, which I think we talked about before here. But that was before we had the Hays Code in America, where there was this censorship of things you could and could not put into Hollywood films. And so this is before that era, where it really, really gets to depicting gangsters. So I sent you a few clips because it was very, really hard to find like an actual trailer for this movie because it's so old. But it stars James Cagney, who is one of the most famous and remarkable actors of the classic Hollywood period, as Tom Powers, who is a man who rises in the ranks of bootlegging scheme. And so you see him kind of go from, you know, sort of poor to his riches and then his downfall, which is the classic setup for any great gangster film. But getting down to those values and loyalty things, this film really sets him up for his antagonist to be his brother, who is not a gangster. And so his brother is a member of straight society. And so there's this clash of ideologies between how Tom makes a living and how his brother makes a living, and how they don't approve of each other, and how this fragile relationship is depicted in the eyes of their mother. And that her perception is one of the only things that Tom really cares about. And so you kind of get this sense of his loyalty to his family, even though he's this murderer and bootlegger. But it's a really famous film. It's got the great ending where he's, you know, I'm not going to spoil, it's not going to be spoiling anything for me to say that, you know, it ends with him getting shot and walking in the rain, where when he falls down and he says, I ain't that tough, and he falls over after being shot. And it really sets the tone for every gangster film after that, like the rise and fall of this gangster. And it doesn't miss its messages in the end when it shows that this lifestyle is going to get you killed. It trickles down through everything. You could tell, you know, the rise and fall in Goodfellas, you know, the attraction of this lifestyle, even down to the Sopranos, where Tony watches the movie when he's coping with the death of his mother, and watching the depiction of this loving mother and her gangster son in this film, like 60 years before or 70 years before the Sopranos had come out. And so, yeah, it's a seminal film in the genre. And I wanted to pick this one just to spotlight, you know, just to show where the genre spawned from.
I like that you gave a 91 year spoiler warning, because I hadn't seen this one either. I knew of it though, and like you said, the actor is one of the most famous actors from the classic Hollywood period. And at first I was a bit confused because it was three different clips, and I was like, well, what's going on here? And then I was like, I saw the Sopranos clip, and then so I'll go into the first one I watched was the one in the rain. So it starts off with your protagonist just being a total creeper, sociopath, standing in the rain, watching some people as they go into a building. And then he just walks into the building with two guns, unloads, comes out, shot, throws his two guns in the windows, walks off in the rain. And like you said, says, I guess I'm not that tough, and it dies. And it's like, damn, like craziness. And I think it's somewhat an accurate depiction too, because like we said for the previous film, sane people don't necessarily go into organized crime and do the horrible acts and then claim it's about family as their justification for it. Like, it's just not how non-sociopathic people live. And so, and then I looked at the second clip and the third clip, and the, you know, you could see the duality with the family, and the mother obviously did think that her son was great. But the brother was just like, you know what, Ma? No, no. No, I think this is a good pick. And I think it's important because they were, like you said, there were a lot of gangster films in the 1930s and after, because, you know, Hollywood was popping up, but Prohibition, even though Prohibition was going on, people still drank and people still like to watch movies about people living the life and, you know, how alcohol was getting to them and about famous people. You know, Al Capone was a movie star, basically, even though he wasn't a movie star, but everyone knew who he was. Bonnie and Clyde were, you know, sensations of the entire nation. There were plenty of people like that. But this movie, point blank, at a time and era where the American public might have been in love with some of this fictitious idea about who these people were, this kind of shows them, look, these people aren't nice people. You should not you should not sympathize for Al Capone. You should not sympathize for Bonnie and Clyde. Like, these are murderers. I think it's cool to throw it back all the way to 1931 and show that there was still some realism out there trying to show people something different. All right, buddy, why don't you take us into your number two on your list?
Yeah, number two, I picked one of the most famous gangster films of all time. It is Scarface from 1983. I fucking love this movie. but before I get into all that, I mean, this is a movie that has penetrated pop culture probably everywhere. I mean, so many people quote it. They quote the "Say Hello to My Little Friend" quote from the end. It's in, it's all over hip hop. It's in, you know, you'll see paintings of people that people make of like Tony Soprano and Tony Montana and Vito Corleone, like playing poker and whatnot. So this is just a massively successful movie, although I don't think it was very successful when it came out or in its original theatrical run. But it's a remake of a 1930s gangster film called Scarface, which was a loose telling of Al Capone, because Al Capone did have a scar on his face. That was his nickname. But this one updates it to the 80s to talk about a different type of organized crime, the cocaine trade. And I mean, this is a hugely bombastic movie. It's almost 3 hours, if not clocking in right at 3 hours, about the rise and fall of Tony Montana, who arrives in America in Florida from Cuba and takes over the cocaine empire there. But it takes its central story from the original, which is about this, the loyalty and the love between Tony and his sister and his best friend, and how all of these loyalties and love kind of get really destroyed by a life of crime. But here it's like Tony rising with his friend Manny, and all those sort of family bonds and loyalty kind of go out the window as Tony just proves to be an utter monster as he's murdering everyone he works for and ultimately kind of kills everyone that he loves. And that only leads to his downfall. But what I find fascinating about this film is that it's not really about the cocaine trade. It's really about American excess and, just the garish qualities of Miami that are in the film. The gangster life in this film is so bombastic that it's pushed to a level of almost cartoonish quality. Pacino's performance, although you could criticize it, but I think it's purposely cartoonish. And it's just, it lampoons the idea of this American dream. It makes it as this hedonistic ideal as opposed to this way of allowing yourself a peace and prosperity. It's more about the lust and the greed that comes with our capitalist society. So Scorsese famously said that he thought this movie was about the excess of Hollywood lifestyle. So I think that's an accurate or a good way of interpreting this film. But yeah, this is the most colorful, bombastic gangster film ever made. And that's why I had to put it on this list.
So many things to say. I agree with you on a lot of them. So I would say, and I'll tell listeners out there too, you were the person who first showed me this movie. I first watched this movie with you quite a few years back. And man, yeah, I can see why you put it on number two. And I'll say, like, as far as pop culture, even today, so every year universities, we always do at the beginning of the semester in the fall, big old poster sales, you know, that way people can like buy a whole bunch of movie posters or gaming posters and put them all up over their apartments and their dorms and stuff like that. And every single year, there are always massive stacks of different kinds of Scarface posters.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and even when I was an undergrad, people still had, I'm slipping on the term. I'm thinking Salvador Dali, but it was Scarface posters all over the place. I say that because I had a Salvador Dali one in mine and my roommate had a Scarface one. I'm going to say, I like the artist more than just like, anyway.
Yeah.
So man, this film, as far as the excesses of the American dream and the ambition, once you get to this country on what you can do and what you can achieve, you just have to be willing to do it no matter what the cost.
Mm-hmm.
I think you're absolutely right. And I think this is like a huge indictment on the American way of life. And like, when is enough? Like you can have millions upon millions, you can have lavish lifestyle, lavish houses, cars and everything, but when is enough enough? You know, the idea of an American dream isn't a stopping point. There's just the dream and it just keeps going. And Tony Montana is completely drawn in by that and never does find enough until he completely ruins everything in his life, for sure. But I do have a question for you.
Yeah, go ahead.
So this one makes me think. So 1983, like you said, the Scarface was originally, you know, about Al Capone loosely, but it was about Italian mafia. And much of cinema was about either Prohibition or mafia related or Irish related, but still very much in that wheelhouse. To me, I'm sure there were definitely other examples out there. I just am not thinking of them or not aware of them. Scarface represents a very particular shift in Hollywood making of organized crime films, from going from focusing on things like The Godfather and Italian mafia to other demographics in society and other organized crime elements out there. And in this one, like you get Cuba and you also get some South America drawn into it. You would be able to tell better than I would. Would you say that's necessarily the case? Like, is this the starting point for where Hollywood starts covering organized crime in other ethnicities, races, countries, and things like this? Or was it happening a lot before?
I would struggle to find a film movie from Hollywood before this one that really digs into these other avenues. I think maybe there's some Irish influences, like, you know, Boston set films or.
Sure. That's what I was thinking too.
Yeah. And then I could think of some other crime films that weren't necessarily family oriented or organized crime oriented that would be taking place in other parts of the city, especially LA or like in the Midwest or something. But this really starts to focus on a new enterprise that really wasn't depicted in a lot of crime films. And it's the cocaine trade, the drug trade, because, you know, historically, the mafia had a no drug policy because of
right
the consequences that come with that of trading drugs and also the way that drugs, you know, influence operations. And so I think another thing that happens is the cultural shift of our focus away from the Italian as the immigrant to the Hispanic as the immigrant. And there is a lot to say in the vilification of the immigrant in the original Scarface as this, you know, the fear of the Italian as the other, or in the 80s, the fear of what we're doing now, the immigrant, the fear of the immigrant coming in. And so there is that kind of, that could be read into these films, the nastiness that's kind of pointed towards that. But I think, yeah, to answer your question, yeah, I think this really does start to open the door to start depicting other tales of organized crime and other focus. And really, if you think about it, like the drug trade has blown the mafia out of the water as far as like the most prevalent, you know, organized crime in modern times. Like the mafia pretty much is destroyed, and the FBI destroyed it. Basically, they made it harder for them to operate. There's laws passed that they can arrest people, the RICO laws, to arrest people who are in organized crime. And so the drug trade is the one that's it's built up in militaristic ways, and the network is so big. And then of course it's feeding a customer that is hard to, you know, what's the answer to stopping the people that want what they have or want what they are selling versus racketeering or protection money or stuff like that the mafia was into.
Right. And a good portion of that we're going to get into too, because I feel like you're two steps away from walking into a question I want to ask you, but I want us to get to our number one first.
Yes.
All right, so what is your top gangster flick
Yeah, number one is Casino from 1995. I think this is probably the greatest gangster film ever made. Full stop there. It's made by the great director Martin Scorsese, who directed Goodfellas, The Departed, The Irishman, Mean Streets. He's one of the most prolific American filmmakers ever, and he's made a lot of great films, and he's also made a lot of great gangster films. But this one specifically, I like it for a few reasons. One is because it's depicting the mafia at the highest level of their power in Las Vegas, in this large spread network of operations. So it's Vegas, it's Kansas City, it's New York, it's all this stuff. And you see how these things move across the country and how wide the mafia's influence and reach really were at a certain time. And I think this film stretches really from like the late 60s through the 80s. And it just shows how the mafia had power and how they fucked it all up and how they just basically ate each other or ate themselves. And that greed and that lust for power really destroyed them. And it also shows how the FBI slowly comes in to really being focused on them and taking them down. But also, like, as a film, like, it gets compared a lot to Goodfellas because it deals with a lot of the same things. But I think it's just a much richer environment. The characters are pushed even further to showing the excesses. The egomania of this film is out of control. It really shows like the kinds of people that are get involved in this lifestyle and to reach the levels that they do, just how brutal and savage they have to be and how out of control they really are. But it's a really experimental film. There's a lot of wild camera work in this movie, and it's got a lot of great photography in here as well, and the performances are spectacular with De Niro and Pesci, and Sharon Stone is fantastic in the movie. But at the heart of the movie, it really gets to where the mafia ends, and I've said this multiple times here, and where the corporations took over and how there are now faceless multi-million dollar enterprises that are ripping people off, as opposed to it being the mafia in this country, who are now basically out of nowhere. They're just, you know, they're gone. They're
completely underground.
Yeah, completely underground, eradicated. They still exist. You still see articles about them, but completely diminished by their own choices. And of course, the FBI taking specific steps to eradicate them. So this is a great movie that just really shows the end of all of it.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And especially to connect it to what we were saying about, you know, the bridging between where the mafia used to live out in the open to technology getting better and better, to wiretaps, to surveillance, to video footage, cameras, you know, and being able to bug an apartment or anywhere or bug a phone line. Like, the mafia had to evolve into that. And it was just like the US federal government was just getting more and more technologically advanced. And the mafia was trying to live this Vegas lifestyle, and it works perfectly because Casino takes place in Vegas, but it was all over the country. The organized crime lifestyle was a Vegas lifestyle of living out in the open. But now that cameras exist, you know, video cameras and audio recording exist, like, you can't live like that because you're producing your own evidence against you. Mm-hmm. And then this movie just, I think, like you said, does a perfect job of showing how these characters eat themselves alive and lead to their own self-destruction. And this was another film that you introduced me to back in the day that I first watched with you. And I remember loving it. And I saw it on TV, I don't know, within the past few months. And my feelings kind of changed a little bit now, because back then it was just like, wow, this is so much, so like such a great film. And like when I watched it a few months ago, I was like, man, I love to hate these characters. like really, I think in retrospect, looking back, I think Martin Scorsese was in many ways trying to show us that these people, look at all these things that they have, but these are horrible people. Like, I don't want you to like this character. And I think as I've aged with the film, I don't like the characters. I like the film, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. the characters are just despicable human beings, you know, all Absolutely. Of them up and down. But I think this is such a bombastic way to show it. And I think the fact that it is in Vegas, so it's bright lights in your face, casinos and all this kind of stuff. It's a different take on Italian mafia films that center around New York and more of a grayer and blues and kind of darker drab colors in the lifestyle versus the color scheme of Casino, completely different.
Yeah. I think also just to point out for anyone who's not familiar with Scorsese or has a kind of an idea that he made all these gangster films, I think one of the things that he does better than anybody is he was really, as a filmmaker, really able to hone in on what the temptation is to join these lifestyles. What's the temptation that pushes someone into joining a life of crime? And the trappings of loyalty, either from growing up in New York and seeing from an Italian-American background or the Catholic background that he was from, really shows the struggle of people once they get into these hierarchy situations, like how it's difficult to portray those things, even though you got to look out for yourself. And he was a cocaine addict for a little bit in the 70s when he first got to LA, Hollywood. And I think he's one of the few people who was able to survive that and then look back on it and say, like, he understands how these power organizations lure you in and how they spit you out. And unlike any other director, he really knows how to depict that life of coming into something that's so exciting and then show you just how far people fall and how ugly it is once you're churned out of that system. And Casino is, to me, his masterpiece in illustrating that.
Well, I like how you put all of that together. And it also makes me think of something you said about the Mikey and Nikki film. You said, you know, they're two older organized crime members. And you're like, well, they're not older, they're middle-aged. And taking that statement right there, the middle-aged, and bridging it together with what you're talking about with Scorsese and seeing how the lifestyle of going down that path, it draws you in. But then you see the ugly side of it. And the truth is, for a middle-aged person in organized crime, you are old. Mm-hmm. Like, there is a shelf life to that lifestyle. You don't make it out alive. And so if you're middle-aged in that lifestyle, you are an old person, really. And I think this does a pretty good job of kind of showing that. Like, this is a younger Joe Pesci. This is a younger Robert De Niro, Sharon Stone. Like, all the people, they're in their 30s-ish, maybe going into their 40s. They aren't really old. But then, you know, there are very few old people that are there. And I think it's pretty representative of this lifestyle in general. It is not, you're not going to retire on this lifestyle. It's just not going to happen.
Yeah, so you really have to get, have obtained some power to be middle-aged and successful in these hierarchies. Because if you're a foot soldier and you're middle-aged, then yeah, you're hustling every day so that you're just killing yourself, basically, to make a living every day by hustling and keeping odd hours, and you're not going anywhere if that's where you are.
That makes me think of Lefty Ruggiero from Donnie Brasco.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, now it's time for our Q&A section with you, Gregory Day. That's a great top 10 list. But start off, why do you want to do this list? What made you pick this list, top 10 gangster flicks?
Yeah. So just continuing to talk about genres on these top 10 lists here. And this is one that I think you and I both really love. So I wanted to get the opportunity to talk to you about them. But it's also one of the most prevalent genres in American movies, and of course there's a ton of examples, as we talked about, across the world that are also interested in this genre, because it allows for so many different things to explore: greed or fantastic characters or our societal issues. And so it just encompasses a lot of things that I find intriguing, but also makes for some very fantastic movie making.
Excellent. I think you're absolutely right. I think that the gangster film, the mafia film, is a quintessential part of American Hollywood culture. Mm-hmm. Without a doubt, we have this fascination with organized crime all throughout the 1900s and going into the 2000s. We'll talk about the 2000s a little bit more in a second. Yeah. But next one, I always like to ask you, because 10 is, it's such a limited number, and you know, you go for around the world and stuff. So you have any runners up, some love you want to throw out there to a couple of films you couldn't talk about?
Yeah. There's quite a few different Yakuza films I really love that I couldn't fit in here because I didn't want to get too redundant. But there's some great Yakuza films from the 60s, whether that's Tokyo Drifter or Branded to Kill, or the Gangster VIP series. And they're a different tone than Street Mobster. Street Mobster, like you brought up, the chaotic nature of that. These are a little more studio-based productions. And so they're a lot cooler. They're a lot more idolized, and they have a lot of almost like musical quality to them with the sets and the productions and the wardrobes and all that stuff. But one film I was debating about putting on here, because it's not exactly a gangster film, but it does would cover a more comedic stance on the gangster film, was Ghost Dog, The Way of the Samurai. It's another Ghost Jim Jarmusch Dog. Film.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, Ghost Dog, this one is not really about gangsters, because Ghost Dog, the central character, is a hitman, but he lives by the code of Bushido, I believe. I might be thinking of the wrong thing here, but he lives the life of a samurai, a solitary man who is a gangster he's a hitman for the New York Mafia. But the way that the film depicts the mafia, they're a comedic bunch. They're a bunch of like broad stereotypes. But Jarmusch is from New York, and he has a love for not only gangster films, but for the people that he's encountered in Brooklyn, and that kind of comes through with a lot of New York actors in the film. And so I thought about adding that just because the depiction of the gangsters in that movie are so great and they're so funny. But I just couldn't find a way to like really represent that the film in this list.
Sure. I think because in a lot of ways, you're right, it does, because the protagonist there is Forrest Whitaker, and he's not part of the family. He's a hitman. So it's really like focusing on the hitman's journey and his his way of the samurai. And so I think, yeah, man, that's a pretty cool movie. I remember watching it. So the second you said that, I was like, yes, indeed.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess just to kind of explain a little bit better, he is, you know, like the samurai is loyal to his the shogun or whatnot during the feudal Japan. He is loyal to his the gangster who is the man who saved his life. So there is that sort of loyalty going on there. But we're talking about gangsters who are really into Flavor Flav, and there's just like these stuff going, you know, these kinds of comedic portrayals of gangsters who are out of touch with reality, which I think makes for great comedy.
Sure. Yeah. And it's not very often you think of comedy in a gangster film. Yeah. And to that same thing about what do you think of when you think of a gangster film? It leads me to my next one. And this is actually going to lead to a few branch off questions and a larger discussion about, you know, at the very beginning of the show, we talked about how, what does gangster film mean and how that word has evolved. And, you know, it's really been quite a while for me since I've seen a film like Goodfellas or Gotti or Knockaround Guys or Casino or Donnie Brasco, any of these like classics of Italian mafia dramas come out. And I'm curious, what do you think? Do you think that the idea of the drama mafia film, the gangster film, is gone, and that a gangster film has evolved to be something different? What do you think about that?
I think there are many number of things coming out of this, but yes, I think traditionally it's hard for me to imagine what something brand new would come out. Because I think the fast-paced, funny gangster film, like a Snatch or any other like kind of high, like fun loving gangster film, might be dead. I don't know. And I think artists are really taking these lives seriously and wanting to explore different aspects of our existence and like our financial institutions with these stories. So that I think is dead. But I think the last two great American works of art that really, I think, put the nail in the coffin of what the Italian American genre is, Italian American mafia genre, would be The Sopranos, which I don't want to get too far into because it's not a film, but right. I do think it's probably the greatest work of art in the that stemmed out of the mafia mafia entertainment, and Scorsese's Irishman,
right?
Which I'm not sure if you've seen that, but I think really that's the film where he makes it a point to say that there is nothing in this life for anybody. And that's a movie where nothing is ever depicted as fun. Nothing is depicted as tempting. Nothing is really, there's no real fruits of this life. It's a hollow, empty life that is going to get you and everyone involved in it killed or put in jail. And I think those last two things, even though The Sopranos is debuted over 20 years ago, is still relevant today to showing that this, you know, the minimization of that lifestyle, the anxieties it creates, and just how small those operations have gotten.
Yeah, and I think you're right to bring it into a different a medium, because I do think, especially the, because almost all the movies we talked about today were straight drama. Like, yes, they were part of a specific genre, but they were a drama. I think today, action is so important in a film to captivate people. I don't really see dramas drawing people in, except for like at the Academy Awards, you know, like those are the only people who are watching dramas all the time. But like audiences, if you look at box office numbers, they're looking for the action films, the comedy films, or the kids films. You know, those are the ones that make the real bucks. Yeah. And as far as the mafia story, it has been told so much. And because the mafia have had to go so underground because of things like John Gotti in the 1990s and then later in different other families around the country, the mafia isn't what it used to be. But what is taking its place, at least it seems to me, is, you know, I think of organized crime films today, I think of action films that center around the cartels and drugs. Sure. Movies like Sicario, for example, I think is a pretty good representation.
That's an excellent example. Yeah.
And then also, I think we do get a lot of short form or the small screen, you know, on television. Like, so the on TV, you have things like the show Mayans, or you have things like Breaking Bad, or you have things like, one that just slipped my mind, but basically organized crime or drug TV shows that just focus on the drug dealer aspect of organized crime. Because it seems like it's easier for criminals to make money off of drugs than it is off of all the other things that mafia did back in the day. Sure. So I kind of feel like it's kind of reflected on what society has changed into and what our criminals have changed into as to what we're interested in watching today. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I would totally agree, because I think also there's an escalation, not only in actual crime violence, but in our craving or depiction of it in cinema. So I'd say it would probably be hard to have a Godfather kind of film come out, a slow romanticized version of organized crime versus the action driven, you know, kind of cartel based films that are like Sicario coming out, that have more of a thriller edge to them than a straight drama. So I think that's where we are now, and that may be where we stay for a while as far as our gangster films go.
Yeah, and I'm sure you heard about, even Scarface is being remade. So they're remaking a remake. Mm-hmm. And I think the focus, if I remember correctly, last I read, was shifting instead of, so originally it was Italian, then it switched to Cuban and South American, now it's switching to Mexican cartels. So it's like a re-updating of the genre. And I'm pretty sure it's going to be pretty action-packed, just because that's what audiences want these days.
Yeah, absolutely.
I will say, so I have one question and then one comment. I'll do my comment first. I was a little surprised I didn't see Eastern Promises on your list. For those of you who don't know what Eastern Promises is, this is your protagonist is Viggo Mortensen. He was made famous in The Lord of the Rings as Aragorn, and he is a special agent, but he's undercover with the Russian Bratva. And I think Eastern Promises is probably one of the most recent and best dramas for organized crimes. But it was a different kind, you know, it's the Bratva versus the Italians. Have you ever seen that one?
I have. Yes. It's a really good picture, directed by famed horror master David Cronenberg. I have to admit that is a picture I overlooked when researching this list. So I'm glad you brought it up.
Yeah, and like I said, it's one of the more recent ones too. And we don't see, so like when we think of organized crime around the world, so you have the mafia, you have the triads, you have the yakuzas, you have the cartels, and the Bratva, I find, only get talked about sometimes, but they're extremely relevant as far as international crime syndicates go. But then my next question for you is just like a quick side question, because it's overly obvious when you look at the genre in total that these are male-dominated films. I mean, almost exclusively male-dominated. Oh, yeah. Are there any examples out there of like female-led gangster films? I mean, I have no idea. I'm just kind of curious if there's anything you can give us out there.
That's a tough one. I mean, yeah, there's as far as going deep into organized crime, I don't really think that there's I would say an example of a female-led or all-female organized crime crew, like in film. There was a, I'm blanking on the name of it, but the Steve McQueen directed movie from not too long ago was about a crew of wives who have to get together to rip off.
Oh, because their husbands failed at it. Yes, I know what you're
their husbands
talking about.
At it. I think their husbands get killed. I actually never saw that one, but like they end up like having to pay off the debts of their husbands, so they kind of get their crew together. But I want to say films like The Long Good Friday, Goodfellas, Casino do go out of their way to show the female participation in these lifestyles. So I didn't really talk about them that much in here, but like in The Long Good Friday, Bob Hoskins' wife is played by Helen Mirren, and she is just as involved in his operation as he is. Like, she's counseling him on things. She knows she's not just some trophy wife or someone who's looking for money. She is all in on her husband's lifestyle and is helping him make decisions on things. I think Goodfellas is a great example of showing Henry's wife's point of view of the lifestyle of being married to a gangster, the attraction it has to her, the excitement that lures her in, and played by Lorraine Bracco, who is a fantastic actor as well. And then showing the consequences of having a husband like this, and you know how these men are not loyal, and then you know not knowing where your money's coming from, and just the danger from that part of his life kind of sneaking into your life. So I think there's a lot of great ways to show this, even though I think in real life there are women who do participate in these organizations, but in many aspects all of these organizations are patriarchal, and the women who are involved in these things do get do also see the consequences of those lifestyles.
Yeah, I think that is a good thing to point out, that a lot of these films that depict these family-oriented organizations like the Mafia, the Yakuza, the Triad, even the Bratwurst, these are patriarchal organized criminal organizations. So like if they're male-dominated organizations, that's why films that focus on them have a lot of male protagonist. Makes sense. But I did look up the film that we were talking about. So that's Widow,
okay.
Starring Viola Davis, Michelle Rodriguez, Elizabeth Debicki. And that came out in 2018. That was a really good one. I had forgot about that one too. But I'm curious, there has to be some other ones. I think also in there, a TV show called Claws, that's a TV show about women who have their own drug dealing business. So I think there is starting to be a branching out. And I think I've heard of a few others more recently that are female led, that are really starting to branch out of the idea that this kind of lifestyle may have just been male dominated at one time, and in the films about it were male dominated, is starting to change. And I think if you look at real life examples as well, so a lot of people may be familiar with the Mexican cartel leader El Chapo, who was extradited to the United States and he was convicted here, but his wife is also being charged for drug racketing or drug charges and racketeering and different things like this, for being just as involved in the cartel business, especially after El Chapo was arrested. She did a lot of it on her own as well. So I'd be interested to like see a film about something like that. That would be pretty interesting.
Yeah. I think just to throw in another really great example that explores that is, there is that episode in The Sopranos where Tony goes to Italy and he sees that the family on the Italian side is run by a woman.
And it kind of starts to, I remember that as well, yes. Yeah,
starts to explore those dynamics of the American patriarchy versus how the Italians perceive the power structure and all that stuff. So I think that's interesting.
Oh, that's a good example too. Yeah, very good. All right, one last question for you, the one we always come back to with any list. And as always, two-parter for you. Why is this list specifically important to you? And why should other people view this list as important as well?
Yeah, it's important to me because, I mean, this is one of the greatest genres of cinema ever. And you could, you know, as we've talked about, it's just so widespread and kind of touches on so many different things across the planet. But I love, specifically for me, I love exploring these characters that are outside our society norms, and it allows for, you know, great action scenes or great depictions of violence on screen, but it's also allows for some really cool character dynamics to be explored. And that's, you know, that's, I guess that's what I find the most fascinating about the gangster film. But why this list is important, I think it's somewhat of a dying art in our current movie situation. Even though I think many of these big characters, your Tony Montanas, your Vito Corleones, are still in our pop culture because they've kind of branched into, the torch has been carried by hip hop culture. And, you know, that stuff is continuing to be perpetuated. I mean, there's video games and stuff based on all these movies as well. But I do think right now there aren't that many gangster films being produced, and not as minimized as like the Western per se, but I think we've kind of moved away from those things, and we're having other types of crime films coming in, whether they are, like we mentioned, about the cartel or about something like The Wolf of Wall Street, which is more about those organized crimes being set in the white collar world. And so there's this whole world of great gangster films for the, you know, first century of cinema that I think are fantastic examples of movies, but also great tales that I think most people could appreciate.
Excellent stuff right there. And Gregory, before you take off for the day, why don't you tell the good listeners at home what you've been working on lately and where they can reach you on the webs?
Yeah. You can follow me on Instagram. I'm at HipsvilleAD. That's my handle on there. And that is connected to my blog, which I post deep dives and essays on exploitation cinema and genre cinema and the occasional art house flick. But right now I'm in the middle of my Real Revenge series, which is exploring revenge in cinema as its own genre, the subgenre of like the thriller or the drama. But it's a great device of telling thrilling stories, especially in the exploitation world. So head over to Substack. It's badday.substack.com and check out those essays.
Yes, definitely check out those essays. And thank you so much, my friend, for coming on, as always. And that's HipsvilleAD's Top 10 List. Check out our friend Gregory Day online. Follow him everywhere. And definitely check out LoFiPoliSci.com for all your lo-fi updates. Always remember that Lo-Fi Poli-Sci is more than just me. It's the we that we be. Talk to you soon, lo-fi listeners. Pickering and Day, signing off.
Ciao.